Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for those of you who don't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. This series was created to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a wide-ranging and deep public dialogue about how spiritual practice and higher levels of consciousness can play a key role in helping us rise to the challenges of a time of crisis and make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. So I've held a whole series of really amazing conversations on this topic with many of today's leading spiritual teachers and thought leaders. And once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This afternoon, depending on what part of the world you're in, for those of us in on the other side of the Pacific, I guess it's morning, I'm really delighted to be joined by Bruce Lipton, and we're going to continue that conversation in a dialogue we've titled Humanity is on the Brink of Spontaneous Evolution. So the way this will work is I'll introduce Bruce, and then we'll dialogue for about an hour, and then I'll make some announcements, and then we'll spend about a half an hour taking your questions, and we'll finish up in about 90 minutes. Bruce Lipton, PhD, is a stem cell biologist who was on the faculty of the University of Wisconsin's School of Medicine for many years, where he did original research on muscular dystrophy and human stem cells, eventually producing breakthrough studies on the cell membrane, which revealed that this outer layer of the cell is an organic homologue of a computer chip, the cell's equivalent of a brain. He later moved to Stanford University School of Medicine, where his research between 1987 and 92 revealed that the environment operating through the membrane controlled the behavior and the physiology of the cell, turning genes on and off, and presaging the emerging science of epigenetics. His deepened understanding of cell biology highlighted the mechanisms by which the mind controls bodily functions and implied the existence of spirit. He applied this science in his personal biology, and his physical well-being and the quality of his daily life improved dramatically. If you meet him, you'll see. He's a very charismatic, radiant, energetic guy. And he's taken his award-winning medical school lectures to the public. And he's currently a very sought-after keynote speaker and workshop presenter. He's the author of the books The Biology of Belief and Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future and a Way to Get There from Here. One of the things I really appreciate about Bruce is his warmth and his vivacity. He's really alive, and he really loves people and their potentials. I first met him in Colorado over a decade ago when he first started giving this kind of talk before the publication of his first book, Biology of Belief. And I was struck immediately by how immediately he electrified the crowd there of scientists and researchers who'd gathered at this conference where we were both speaking. It's been no surprise to see the groundswell of tremendous interest his work has attracted. So thank you for being here with me today, Bruce. I'm really happy to have you here.
Terry, I so appreciate this opportunity, and I want to thank you because, as you know, I get so excited just by the opportunity of getting a chance to talk to people and say, It's not as bad as you think. We're going someplace good. So I appreciate this time. Thank you.
Yeah, terrific. Well, you know, I think it probably would be really good for us to start off with at least a brief orientation to the fundamental theses underneath your work. You know, I know that it's so rich and nuanced, two books, you know, whole courses, but it would really be a delight to hear, you know, a short 5 to 10 minute summary of how you're study of cell membranes and biology drew you to become such a passionate advocate for the transformational powers of human consciousness?
Well, the starting premise is, first of all, I wasn't spiritual at all and was shying away from it so much that I sought out science as my place to find truth. So when I got into science, I was pretty much the conventional reductionistic mechanistic scientist and looking at the physical structure and molecules and genes and, you know, looking at life as this machine automaton. and teaching the same kind of stuff, in fact, to medical students. And I was cloning stem cells. As you mentioned, I'm a stem cell biologist. I started cloning stem cells back in, actually, 1967. So at that time, there were very few of us in the whole world that actually had any concept or work with stem cells. And so it was a pretty interesting time. But the research, the first research I did, just blew my mind and changed my whole life and led me on a new path. And it was a very simple experiment. I just basically, I put one stem cell in a petri dish, and it grows by dividing every 10 or 12 hours. So first one, then two, four, eight, 16, et cetera. And 2 weeks, I've got thousands of cells in the petri dish. But the most important understanding is that all the cells are genetically identical because they came from the same parent. And then the real experiment was this, is I took that petri dish with thousands of cells, split up the cells, and put them into three other petri dishes, split them up into three. And I changed the culture medium, and the culture medium to the cells is the environment. So you create an environment in which cells live, and I changed some of the composition of the culture medium in each of the three cultures. And so in environment A, the cells that I put in there form muscle, and in environment B, the cells that I put in there form bone, and environment C, the cells that I put in that petri dish form fat. And basically, you're left with a profound but very important question: what controls the fate of the cells? And the answer comes down to the first thing, is they were all genetically identical, so it wasn't predisposed in the genes in that way. It was a response to the environment. And a very simple point, I take a healthy set of cells and put the dishes in a less than optimum environment, and the cells start to get sick. And if you were a conventional allopath medical type doctor, you say, well, geez, I wonder what kind of drugs you should give your cells. And I say, absolutely no drugs at all. All you have to do is take the dish from the less than optimum environment, return it to the good environment, and instantaneously the cells get well. So the story of my cells in the plastic dish was really cool, except there's an interesting insight about humans, and that is when we look in the mirror and see ourselves, we frequently see a single entity looking back. So I see Bruce, you see Terry looking back, and I say, oh, that's a single human. I go, well, that's a single human, but a human by definition is actually assembled from 50 trillion cells. It's the cells that are the living entity. The human, by its definition, is a community of cells. And so the interesting insight, and it comes down to this simplicity, is that a human being is the equivalent of a skin-covered petri dish. And inside, under our skin, we got these 50 trillion cells. And then I say, and what about the growth medium? I say, well, that's the blood. And then I say, well, if you change the composition of the blood, then you change the phase of the cells. And the answer is, this is absolutely true. It's exactly the same whether it's a plastic dish or a skin-covered dish. The cells respond to the culture medium, the environmental information. And then I say, well, so then the chemical composition of the blood controls the fate and genetics of the cell. And it goes, yes. And I go, okay, so the brain releases these chemicals. And then I go, yes. And then I go, but what chemicals does the brain release? And then all of a sudden, we realize we take a jump now. And the answer is, it's based on what you perceive in the world. So if you open your eyes and you see someone you love, you release chemistry into your blood, such as dopamine, oxytocin, nerve growth factor, growth hormone. These are wonderful chemicals. If I put those chemicals into my petri dishes, the cells grow and flourish and have tremendous quantities of energy involved. And that's why you as a human body, when you fall in love, you can actually feel the health surging through your body, the energy. You have so much energy when you're in love like that. And this is really great because the chemistry that your mind released ultimately controlled the fate of those cells. And I say, well, the same person, but this time they open their eyes and they see something that scares them. And basically I say, oh, well, you don't release any of those neurochemicals from the love vision. When you're scared, you release stress hormones, cytokines, norepinephrine, cortisol, these kind of agents, histamine. And I go, wow, well, those are completely different chemicals released in the blood. I go, yeah, but the blood being the tissue culture medium, in fear, the tissue culture medium has a completely different set of chemistry, which in turn controls the fate of the cells and their genetics. So basically it says, oh my goodness, well, obviously what we have here is this mind-body connection, and the mind-body connection is how a thought is translated into chemistry and how that chemistry then controls the fate of the cell. So that's what my work started when I started to realize this. Oh my God, I'm teaching students about genes controlling this and genes controlling that. It turns out genes absolutely control nothing, and the new science that's all derived from this understanding about how environment controls the cells also reveals that for every gene in our body, the way we perceive or respond to the world, we can alter the activity of that gene to create up to 30,000 different variations of proteins from the same gene blueprint. So basically, it says, oh my God, we're, after teaching for years the concept of genetic determinism, that genes control our lives, et cetera, and that we can't affect the genes, it turns out it's the complete opposite. What I was teaching in medical school was called genetic control, control by genes, which creates victims. And the reason why is, well, you didn't, as far as we know, select the genes you came with, and if you don't like the traits the genes carry, you can't do anything about them, and you realize your life is in a large part predetermined by your genetics, and by definition, you represent a victim. And what the new science is, and it's called epigenetics, genetic control, and it's very interesting. The only difference is that little prefix, EPI, but that little prefix is a complete revolution in civilization. It's a complete revolution because epi means above. So you'll say the word epidermis, and that means the layer above the dermis, which is skin. So there's skin, which is epidermis. So obviously below the skin is the layer called the dermis. So I say epi means above, and I go, so what's epigenetic control? And the answer is very simply control above the genes. And all of a sudden, the world changes. The genes didn't have no control at all. Genes don't turn on and off. Genes make no decisions. Genes are blueprints. And you go to an architect's office, and she's working on a blueprint, and you say to her, is your blueprint on or off? And she'd look at you like, what, are you crazy? It's a blueprint. It's no on and off. And I go, this is the point. Genes are blueprints. There's no on and off. Whether you read them or not is based on what we would call the contractor, and it turns out when you follow the flow of information, the mind is the contractor. It determines what the chemistry that's going to be released by the brain, and how that chemistry ultimately activates the genes determines the fate of your cells in your life. So your perceptions change your genetics. You change your perceptions, and you change your genetic activity. And it's sort of like, well, isn't this exactly what the placebo effect was all about? And the fact is, yeah, it was just your belief that this so-called miracle drug, which turns out to be sugar, you take that drug and you get cured, and then it's like, wow, the drug cured me. And it's like, no, it was sugar. What cured you was the belief. And so we have what is called the placebo effect, and we know one-third to two-thirds of all healing in the medical profession is placebo effect mediated. And what's left out of the conversation and what I want people to hear most is, we talk about the placebo effect, but nobody really talks extensively about something called the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect reveals a very simple truth, that a negative thought is equally as powerful as a positive thought on your biology, but it just works in the opposite direction. Significance is, it's not just positive thinking affects your body, it's thinking affects your body. Positive or negative, equal power, equal influence. And so as much as a placebo positive thinking can heal us, we now recognize that just negative thoughts and can actually precipitate disease, and you can and actually kill you in what is called the nocebo effect. So the whole thing that's so exciting is that I was transitioning from a biology of victimization to a biology of mastery, because it really, we are masters in that we are able to change our perceptions and beliefs and attitudes, and by changing those, we then control and manipulate the genes. So it's a revolution from victim to master, and I think it's most exciting because this is a fundamental element of the evolution that we are, as a civilization, on the threshold of facing right now. Did I talk over my 10 minutes, Eric?
You did great. That was just beautiful. Thank you. And you really summarized it. I thought beautifully. So
thank you.
With that insight, you've gone ahead and you've extended it, and you've said that this isn't something that we should imagine is operating only at the level of our relationship to our own personal health, but it has to do with our shared beliefs and
absolutely
our shared destiny, and that the evolution of the human of every you know, every human subculture and all of the human species cultural evolution in this time in which we're up against some pretty daunting problems of overpopulation and eco-catastrophe and even financial system collapse are amenable to transformation through shifts in our beliefs. And your latest book is focused on that. Maybe it'd be good to kind of connect the dots out and help us see how you imagine that unfolding.
Yeah. Well, the first thing you mentioned was the connection that I created between biology, belief, and the book called Spontaneous Evolution. And basically that connection is that the biology belief book talks about how our own personal beliefs, attitudes, emotions affect our health or our genetics, our behavior, and how we can have health or disease based on the way we respond to the world. And I said, so a personal belief creates your personal life experiences. And then at some point that dawned on me, I said, wait a minute, what if millions and millions of people share the exact same belief? Then it's not just individuals creating their own life. At some point, when the numbers are great enough, the belief shared by the multitude becomes the reality. And the significance is, but they created that reality with their beliefs, and the simple point is, well, they changed their beliefs, they changed the reality. It's absolutely just whether it's your personal life or the life of the community, it's exactly the same. And in understanding this a little bit deeper, there was an extension from the very first work, because the first work I didn't talk about the part of how did that environmental signal actually come into the cell and manipulate the behavior and genetics of the cell. And it came across a study understanding the nature of the cell membrane. And the cell membrane, because the genes turned out not to be the brain of the cell, as we write, it's still in the textbooks, the nucleus is the brain of the cell because that's where the genes are, and the genes control life, so hence the nucleus is the center of control, and it's the brain. Well, it turns out, no, the nucleus is actually reproduction. It's a gonad of the cell. The brain of the cell is the membrane, and what I started to recognize was that if you want to model evolution based on awareness, it turns out that the units of perception, which are protein units built into the membrane, perception, they're actually switches that respond to an environmental signal and then engage an interior function inside the cell. So on the surface of the cell, about 100,000 of these protein switches that are input-output exactly is what they are. And what I started to recognize is, oh, my goodness, evolution is driven by an expansion of surface area. It's the surface area because the perception units in the membrane, these little proteins, can only form a monolayer. I can't stack them up inside the membrane. So that critical point means this. If you want more proteins, more perception, you have to make more membrane surface area. So I give the analogy in the book, like, consider the membrane like a bread and butter sandwich and olives inside the sandwich as these protein units, and that the thickness of the sandwich is just about the same thickness of the olive, so you can't stack olives up. You want more olives, you need a bigger piece of bread. And all of a sudden I said, oh my God, evolution is driven by the expansion of surface area. And the significance was, and I went back over the evolution, because we think of evolution as one continuous thing. Here's a primitive bacterial cell, and then step by step by step by step over billions of years, here's a human being, and it's one continuous thing. And it turns out, absolutely, that is not the way it happened. It started with an organism, bacterium, which reached the fullest membrane size it could reach inside this little capsule-like skeleton, and bacteria actually maxed out their intelligence, and so what they did is learn to come together in a community. The community of bacteria led to the next level of organization called the equivalent of the amoeba, the eukaryotic cell. That larger cell is, by definition, really a community of bacteria that have integrated themselves. I say, oh, so we went from a single organism to a community, and then that community became an integrated single organism itself. So I say, okay, so then the amoeba formed. I say, then what happened? The cells reached a maximum size at that level. Any more membrane you try to add and the cells rupture because they're like water balloons. That too much water causes the balloon to rip. So a membrane holding a cell together can only hold a cell together of a certain size. So guess what? The period of evolution, another billion years of evolution, now there were not just single-cell bacteria, there were single-cell amoebas where they maximized their ability. And you say, well, how did the next level of evolution occur? And I say, oh, the single amoebas started to get together in colonies, and then they formed communities. And a human and a tree and a dog and a clam, these are communities, design communities of amoebas. So a human is a community of 50 trillion amoebas, but we see it as a single entity. So it went from single amoeba, community of amoebas, now into a single entity, in our case, let's say a human. And then I say, yeah, but then what happened when the human maxed out its intelligence? It's like, oh, it started to hook up with other humans, made a colony and a community, and what will be the ultimate destination is when all humans recognize that we are each individual cells in the body of a larger organism that is in a state of evolving or not at this moment. It's questionable, but the larger organism is called humanity. There's a repetitious pattern, and it's also related to fractals, which imply the repetitious pattern. It's really great. So the point about it is this, where are we? We are in a final stage of whether we're going to decide to come together in the wholeness of one giant humanity where each human is the equivalent of a cell in the body of that collective organism. And you say, well, you know, what would be the consequence of that? And I think I go back and tell you, look, you're a body made out of 50 trillion amoebas. And I go and say, what was the consciousness and awareness of that single amoeba? And then I say, and now what's the consciousness and awareness of when you put those 50 trillion amoebas in one body? It's like, oh, my God, from an organism that was running around trying to eat a bacteria here and there, the community of 50 trillion created a rocket ship and went to the moon. So it's like, wow, that's intense. And I go, yeah, and what would be the consequence of 7 billion people coming together and recognizing they're all part of one human body called humanity, where they stop fighting each other and they stop? Because if you ask me is the status we're in right now, the status is simple. We're an evolving organism called humanity, and we're suffering at the moment from what it would be called autoimmune disease, which is by coincidence the same kind of afflictions that are affecting the people, the cells making up this humanity, because when cells fight each other or destroy their relationships with each other, the organism will collapse on that. The diseases that we face in our world today, much of them are all related to this self-destruction. Our beliefs and attitudes and the way we're living are causing our 50 trillion cell community to become disrupted, and that's where the disease comes from. And then I say humanity is on the edge of an evolution right now. The walls that have been separating people for the last 150 years when conventional science was running the world, and we're operating from a Darwinian principle that life is, the evolution is based on the individual and the struggle for survival with the fitness of the individual. So we focused all of our effort on the individual, and it turns out, no, evolution didn't care about the individual. Evolution was the community. And so the awakening that's happening in the world right now is an awakening that's very critical, because it says, as humanity, are we going to make it or not? And I can't tell you whether we will or not. There have been civilizations that got to this point and disappeared, and we could or not. I'm very optimistic that we can, and basically recognize that humans will start to recognize that each other human is a cell in the same body. Then all of a sudden the terror that we have created on this earth among all the cells will disperse, go away, a harmony, a unity, and then I say, and the emergence factor, which means the collective intelligence, will create a future that I don't think anybody at this moment can imagine. It's just in the same way that you talk to an amoeba, if you could, and you say, well, you know, what do you think if we all got together? What could happen? I don't think any of them thought about television sets, cell phones, or rocket ships that would be a consequence of that community. And yet I say, well, what will happen when 7 billion humans finally recognize we're part of the same body, outside of the fact that maybe we'll stop killing each other and stop killing the planet and start to wake up to our responsibility as a super organism? And in that case, we create the next level of evolution, and that is a unity called humanity. And then my perception, of course, is, well, that doesn't end, because then the Earth as a cell essentially is a complete, when all the humans recognize that we're all part of the thing, the Earth is like a complete cell
So we would be recognizing not just our connections with each other as human beings, but our connections with all creation, with all creatures and plants and everything.
Yeah, and we lost that because of a couple of things. We lost that one because of traditional Judeo-Christian belief that said this planet was made and then you were added on top, like an add-on option at the end of the project. And so that gave us, in the religious sense, we were distant from nature, and then that concept of dominating nature got into our cultural mentality. There was a problem there. But then it didn't get any better with science, because when science came in and Darwinian theory said we got here by random mutations or random accidents, then I said, well, why are we here? And you say, well, the only reason we're here is just the random genetics. Then you say, well, then there was no purpose for human existence, and unfortunately that's the way we've been operating. When in truth, when you understand the nature, as you brought up, that we are an integral part of this environment. We were created from the environment. We are principles, as the Native Americans would have said, gardeners in this environment, and we're facing now our own extinction, because science has recognized we're into the sixth mass extinction of life on this planet. The five previous mass extinctions due to things like comets, asteroids hitting the Earth and destroying the environment, blah, blah, blah. This one, science has recognized, is totally due to human behavior. So all of a sudden it says, we are creating our own extinction because of our disconnection from nature, that we, you know, just ran roughshod over the garden and destroyed it, and then wondering why it's not working.
But isn't that a natural process too? I mean,
yeah,
you know,
it is, and it totally is. And there's that's you're, you know, Terry, you're right about this whole thing, because what's happening is not an accident. It's a step. Every step of the way takes us to some level, reach this, you know, this level, and then if we don't make an evolutionary jump, trying to stay at the same level is destructive of the system. And the crises we face, and you can list them all, but they're all one. They're all the same crisis. It's a crisis of evolution, and it basically says that we have to wake up to the reality of who we really are, and our relationship to this beautiful garden. And we've had such, you know, incorrect beliefs up to now that helped us get to where we are, but we now face the crisis, and crisis is what causes evolution. That's exactly the cause of an evolution. You can have all the awareness in your head and sit around and say, I know exactly what we should do and where should we go, but the fact is, not until the crisis reaches a proportion where the percentage of the population is so adversely affected by the crisis that it forces them to make a decision. That's what we're coming to right now. We are gearing up, and people should be totally aware of what's happening here, that the collapse of the system at every level, from politics, economy, academia is collapsing, healthcare is collapsing, religion, all of these, this is a good thing. It's a great thing for a simple reason. These are the systems, institutions that have got us to this point, but we also recognize by continuing those policies, the extinction is written right across the wall right there. It says we're going extinct, we're following the policies we've done, and that's why the crisis that's looming, and the little ones are still, they haven't hit the big one yet, we're coming. And the crisis that is looming are the ones that will shake people up and finally say, no, we cannot do it this way anymore. We either learn to do it this way or, as some people, like even like James Lovelock, the guy who came up with the concept of Gaia, he's already written it off. He said, it's too late. And I'm thinking, it's not too late, because this human consciousness is a most powerful element in the evolution of this planet, and conventional scientists don't really count that into the equation. And it's like you must include this in the equation, because quantum physics, we're living an experiment, and we're observing it, but we're also participating. So this is the critical part about the evolution. Very just interesting point. I was quiet. The point is this. The evolution we're in is not a passive process. It's an active process. Each one of us has to be a participant in this evolution. It's not going to happen by sitting in your easy chair and then one day you open up the door and it's like, wow, the new world. It's like, no, this is a participatory event coming.
That's core to my own work, Bruce. You know, I'm completely aligned to what you're saying there. But there are a lot of folks that challenge me and you saying
sure.
some reasonable things along the lines of, hey, people aren't getting more realizing that they're all connected as they get stressed. They're actually getting more and more selfish, more and more fearful, more and more irritated and angry. You know, the Tea Partiers were angry. The Occupy Wall Street folks are angry. The folks in Greece are angry. The folks in the Arab Spring are angry. Everybody's pointing fingers and playing the blame game. And we may be going toward more division rather than more connection. And, in fact, usually people can make a leap to a more ordered, higher order of thinking and feeling and operating when there's a basic harmony, when their basic stresses are lower. Under stress, people often degenerate and operate from a lower level of their capacity rather than jumping to a higher level. How do you see that? You know, do you see a mechanism through which that pattern will be defied?
Yeah, I really do. I mean, first of all, the stresses that drive humans, there are two kinds of stress. There's eustress and distress. Eustress is good stress. That's the stress like going out and playing sports, athletics, and stuff like that, or stressing your intelligence and pushing on your system to create something better. Is it really interesting because the original term competition meant strive together, meaning that if you challenge me, I'll work harder to do the same thing, and that we're working toward the same goal, and that's really what competition meant. When it became a Darwinian concept, then it was I beat you before you beat me. That changes the name of the game completely, and we've been playing that for 150 years now. And the point about it is the stresses are important, and the issues are, the answers are available, but they're very difficult to get out in a world, and this is just simple logic and reality. The world is being manipulated by a special group of people, a group of interests, and they own the media. And yet, so what do you hear in the media? You hear all the, Wall Street is, you know, all the violence and all the, you know, like all that old kind of, like, get the police in there and club them kind of stuff, you know, building up an antagonism against them. I think this is a lot, we're getting a lot of...
I mean, do you see that as an act of conspiracy or more as a kind of a momentum out of a mindset?
I think conspiracy is a hard word because then you said, they all sat down at the table and they all said, let's do this. I don't think it's that kind of conspiracy. It's a collective conspiracy of, I live in a Darwinian world that says evolution is driven by a struggle for survival, and the fittest ones survive and the weakest ones die, and that's the name of the game. And if I'm fitter and you die, well, then I succeeded, and that's great. And this is a problem because this is a culture that has been groomed on this for 100 more years. And my father never went to school, but he sure as hell knew about the rat race and going out there and struggling for your survival and all that. When it turns out, if you really understand the story of evolution, it was not driven by any means by Darwinian mechanisms at all. It was driven by Lamarckian mechanisms. And Lamarckian mechanisms are mechanisms of cooperation, not competition. Lamarck emphasize the cooperation between organisms and the environment. They live in a harmony with each other. And actually, Lamarck wrote in 1809, the year that he wrote the theory of evolution, and he is the first scientist to write the theory of evolution. Darwin did not write it first. Darwin was 50 years after Lamarck. But when he wrote this back then, he actually said the problems that humanity will face is that they will distance themselves from nature. And this is exactly the crux of the problem that we are in right now. And he said that, and we made him a buffoon in the halls of science, Lamarck. Everybody goes, Lamarck, that's a phony guy, the one that said animals could think and evolve by thinking, like the fish at the edge of the pond says, geez, if I just had some fish I could feed, I could walk out there, and all of a sudden, boom, evolution of feet. And it's sort of like a slanderous attack on a guy who was brilliant. And actually, when Darwin died, before Darwin died, he became Lamarckian. His followers didn't follow him on that. They actually thought he became senile at that moment, but he started to recognize it was the environment that was leading the evolution. We were in a lockstep with that environmental evolution, and this is what we're playing right now. And the coming part and the factions and the factor, all these things that are fractioning all over the place, It is the process of disassembling at every level of the structure, and this is a necessary part of the system. Now, it doesn't have to be violent at all. As a matter of fact, if we had some leadership and awareness and new science that could penetrate the old beliefs, and you say, well, why is the new science having a difficult time penetrating the old beliefs? The answer is the old science made us victims. And by definition, when you're a victim, you need to get, someone to save you. and as a result, when you own yourself as a victim, by definition, you will now give up your energy, money, life, or whatever to the others who will save you from your victimization. That's why, like medicine, is locked in this old belief system is so destructive at conventional medicine right now. But the system doesn't want to change because it's the system that capitalized on the way it's going right now. Even though they know they're killing it, they're still trying to suck the life out of the system, you know, all the money and everything else. And it's like, it's going to have to fall. How? When? Well, we don't have leadership. We don't have the information out in the field. Your program and my talks reach a certain portion of the population, and this is great because these people who are listening, these people who are participants in your conference calls, these are the imaginal cells of the world. These are the cells that are thinking new visions, inquiring minds, looking for new answers. This is the leadership of the next level of civilization. It's the ones that are locked into the old belief systems that don't want to see it change, that have fear, that it's like, oh my God, this thing's going to fall apart. They're the ones that are actually holding back the evolution, and they're the ones that are going to suffer the most because this is an evolution. It's in process, and it has a great opportunity to be the most amazing experience that any human has ever had on this planet to see if we make this the coming together of this super organism called humanity. It's going to be amazing.
That is my intuition too. And yet, like many, for instance, in my conversations with Ken Wilber on this topic, Ken says that he sees a potential tipping point when 10% of the population reaches the integral level of consciousness, the stage of meaning making that kind of begins to break us beyond postmodern. It's kind of technical, but it's something that's happening spontaneously and naturally among a lot of people, like a lot of the people that are listening to us right now. And yet he says he thinks that the transition is going to require a pretty major shock, and that shock would probably create some death and suffering and really knock people back on their heels even more strongly than the very serious crises that we've already experienced. Clearly, we're just trying to cope, even though we've seen thousands and thousands and thousands of people in all parts of the world suffering terrible, strange weather events and various eco-catastrophes and financial debacles and this and that. But the idea is that it will take a bigger shock before we're going to rethink our fundamental assumptions, but that although there will be some real loss and there'll be something to grieve and it will test us and be maybe an initiation spiritually, that'll be a process that will teach all of us something we don't know yet, that out of that there'll be windows of opportunity for more fundamental redesigns of the larger structures of human societies. And it's with the idea in mind that we can now be embodying a different spirit and in very practical ways building the spare parts out of which we can construct a more sustainable way of being here on the planet that I focus my work. But I would like to have more vivid and particular images in mind of how that will actually work, because they have very vivid and particular images of how it's going to break down. There's going to be mass demonstrations, then there's going to be police suppression, then we're going to end up in a police state, yada yada. They have this story of how it goes bad is very particular.
There's many
and
options. Many options and many. One of the early founders of noetic sciences was a guy called Willis Harmon. And he did a lot of work at Stanford and think tank, stuff like that. And it was interesting because back in the early 1980s, I think, the U.S. government commissioned him to make a study specifically on cataclysmic events such as like an economic catastrophe in the United States or a couple of other things like that. They already knew this was looming. They saw that 20-some years ago. It's like a Ponzi scheme at some level that ultimately is going to hit the wall. So they started looking back. They asked Willis Harmon to write up about what he would do. And it was very interesting back then. He said the thing that would – one of the major things that will help the you know, get through this thing is that he said this back then. That was really interesting. He said that people will become more spiritual, will become more conscious. And he talked about, you know, our changing way of life and relationships, and that he brought all that up. But he also brought up, as you mentioned, the concept that he said there'll be a period, and he said, I hope it will be short. But he talked about a period of that lockdown to try to prevent the whole thing to bubble over too much. And so, actually, and it's very interesting because the government has since then built detention camps to hold several million people, because they're already in anticipation that they're going to have to try to keep the order of what they anticipate could be the bad scenario that they think could possibly happen. Looking at the bad side of it, and I'm looking at it could be good, it could be better. I don't know how it's going to play itself out because it's something so dynamic, and it's like. Those things that happened, like the Arab Spring, some guy who was selling something from his cart did something, and boom, the whole thing blew up. It's a butterfly flapping its wings in Indonesia, and you know, in the storm in the United States, it was, you know, driven by that butterfly wing. That's why I don't think there's in understanding the nature of chaos and strange attractors and all these other kinds of things. I have a feeling this is of course, the exciting part is. There is no predictability of what actually is like a sure track. There's nothing. Everything is up for grabs at this moment. It's very exciting. It's very exciting because it's in movement. Because if it isn't in movement, the science recognition of the looming extinction, that's a given reality. They're talking, you know, like within 30 years, the fish will be out of the ocean. It's like, my God, that's almost a science fiction nightmare, and yet that's a scientific reality, and it's because of the way we're living. And so the point was very simply: you cannot live this way anymore. We're going to die. So falling apart to me is the necessary the understanding. Will it be peaceful? It really has a great opportunity to be peaceful for, and as you well know, Terry, the population of people that have become more conscious has gotten to a very large number, but it's not media attention-grabbing stuff. The media is not interested in this at all because the media is owned by the structures that be. They'll feed you what they need to feed you.
Well, and there are even standards of practice in journalism. I was kind of thinking wryly to myself, listening to a news report just a day ago or something. The European leaders had come up with a plan to take care of the various debt problems, and the reporter was saying, "Well, this seems to have worked, but will it endure?" You have to ask this sort of negative question, and that actually. Is how you're taught to do journalism. So rather than helping people to feel any positive faith in the thing that was being done with the interest of preserving a system that a lot of people depend on for their well-being and security, the journalism has to take a negative tack and to instill doubt. It's actually the practice of the craft. It's not just. I don't think people are getting orders from the owners of the papers in every case. I think it's the way they understand their job.
Well, yeah, true, and it depends if they're real journalists. And then you could talk about like Fox News, which is whipping up a frenzy, and that's not journalism. That's
different. That's true. They have that's a corporate. Yeah, they have a propaganda agenda. Yeah,
that's just the more overt one. That's the one that's up in the front that you can see. The other ones do it less overt, more covertly. Because they make policy decisions on the kinds of articles and things they want to say based on whoever they're trying to not step on their toes or whatever it is. It's not free news. This kind of internet stuff and telephone seminar things, this is more real because it's not really put through the grinder of the corporate belief system. And so that's why the internet has been actually the most important evolutionary advance of civilization, and is fundamental because it really represents the nervous system to hold 7 billion cells together in one community. And so it's very exciting.
And we can exchange very different beliefs and very different attitudes and insights and very different spirit. But even those of us who are participating in this in a very positive way have to account for all kinds of things that stimulate fear and concern. We do want to be fact-based, and there are all kinds of facts that certainly, you know, just what you were citing about the oceans, you know, these things are alarming. And how we relate to that bad news and the potential threats to ourselves and our loved ones in a way that remains healthy seems like an important spiritual challenge. It's not always obvious for any of us to understand how to meet.
No, I mean, that's why Occupy Wall Street says, so what are you here for? And nobody has any very specific, you know, like group answer. There is no group answer. Everybody's realizing a simple thing, and it's an interesting thing. It's a biological mechanism. It's called the biological imperative. We don't know biologically where the heck it is in the cells and how it's programmed in there, but there's a given thing. It's a fact, and that is no organism will readily give up its life. In other words, even a bacterium, you say, you try to kill a bacterium, it's not going to sit there and say, okay, I'll wait till you kill me. It's going to do every maneuver possible to stay alive. There's a drive, and it's built into every living organism. And the point about it is when life becomes threatened, the biological imperative sends early alarms out that the field is something's wrong in the field, and that's what people are feeling all over the place. They're just in the pit of their gut. Something, it's not right. Something's wrong. Something's going on, and that's because as a collective mass, civilization is now being pushed by this biological imperative to face a challenge, because that's what the imperative will do, is cause you to face a challenge and do everything in your extent to survive this challenge. So we're all hyped now because we're beginning to say, okay, it's not safe anymore. It's not sustainable anymore. And we're on the edge, and what are we going to do? And it's interesting because in my book, I have a story, the one I wrote with Steve Behrman, Spontaneous Evolution, is a simple story about a Cherokee elder who was talking to his grandchildren. He said, look, I have two wolves, and there's a terrible battle inside of me with these wolves, and it's just a vicious and violent fight. And the grandchildren said, but Grandpa, what are these wolves? And the grandpa said, well, one's the wolf of love and peace, and the other is the wolf of anger and war. And the children said, but Grandpa, which one of these wolves will win? And the grandfather said to him, the one I feed. And this is when you brought up, we are facing the anger, the violence, we're facing all that, and we're also facing another possible alternative. Which one will we go to? And this is where the breakdown is coming right now. And the question is, if you live in fear because of the structure that you're in, and it's scary because you've been living in the structure, and if the structure doesn't maintain itself, you are going to have suffering from this. That's one thing. And the other thing is, but if you see the future, you see a way to move, a way to live, a way to organize that is more sustainable and peaceful and all this other kind of stuff, and you see that, well, now it's your decision. It's a personal decision. I'll stay in fear and try to protect everything I can as this thing is falling down, which I think would be a waste of a lot of energy. And the other one is put the energy into, let's put this thing together. Let's work it out. Let's try the experiments. Let's hear everybody's voice brainstorming on a massive level, because the answers are a necessity. Survival evolution has come to this point of finding the answers. And I feel very, excited about the concept when I started to realize is, look, amoebas did this event before. Amoebas got together to create these giant communities, like 50 trillion amoebas making up a human being. And then you think about it, you say, wait a minute, the human, by definition, is a community of these amoebas. I say, yeah, and biologically and functionally, virtually every cell in your body is the equivalent of a human, because every function that you can tell me you have in your body, virtually every cell has exactly the same functions going on in its body. Cells have respiratory, digestive, excretory, nervous system, reproductive system, cardiovascular system. Cells even have an immune system. And so all of a sudden you say, wait, 50 trillion cells learn to come together in harmony, create technology that even human beings haven't been able to replicate yet. and create a community in which, if you think of a healthy, happy human being, and what you're looking at is 50 trillion sentient cells, little miniature people, living in harmony. Each cell, all the cells have jobs, all the cells get health care, all the cells get their safety taken care of. They're all working in this wonderful community. They have an economy. They have actual money that they use in the system, energy units. And the fact is, my God, 50 trillion of them learn to be together in the sense that if you're experiencing a moment of bliss, you're in truth, what you really have is 50 trillion cells, 50 trillion citizens who have learned to live in harmony, create an economy, a politic, a sociology, a culture. And why is that important? Because the old mystical thing of the answers lie within, it's like, to me, it's like, oh my God, they do. They absolutely lie within. Every cell has a job. Every cell gets paid. Every cell gets health. Everything that we as humans need, we need it because our cells need the exact same thing. So what human drives are really the collective drives of amoebas.
We need to do it consciously, and we need to communicate with each other about it, and we have to be able to tell stories to each other that we can have enough agreement about, even if we have some disagreement, that we can still work together. And we're so far from having any kind of coherence in the way we're telling each other stories. I have an intuition that we really are in the process of a profound transition, but the way that will come about is mysterious, and in some ways it does seem like things are falling apart. Now, you feel a fundamental faith because you see all these analogs and metaphorical resonances with biological evolutionary processes, but the mechanisms will be different, and there is something that we're going to have to be doing right now, the next step, the thing we're not already doing, the thing that there are things that you and I are doing right now by spreading these ideas, by listening respectfully, by probing, by honestly, openly contemplating something beyond what we already know, being more interested in what we don't know than what we already do know. There are all kinds of things that we are doing, but there's probably something more that we aren't doing yet. And you must have some intuition as to what those next moves are and the very practical, doable things that anyone listening to this dialogue between us can take to heart and put into practice right away.
Well, I think the first thing is something that humanity collectively agrees on, is the concept that knowledge is power, and that we are going through a change of knowledge. The knowledge that has provided the grounding of the cultural beliefs in the world that we live in, the civilization that we have, the fundamental knowledge that guided us up to this point is now proven to be faulty and in many cases outright wrong. And why is that relevant? Because when the new knowledge enters civilization, then it by definition will create and generate a new cultural meme, a new belief system, a new way of life. And so the first thing is this: knowledge is power, and we have been disempowered. And the new knowledge of our mastery over our biology, our creative abilities through our consciousness, all of these things are the new understandings. And as I mentioned, it's not really been in the interest of the leadership to offer this to the public, in a sense, is because whether they think they're the parents and we're just too kid-like and they need to control us, whether that's the issue, or whether they're just greedy because they people that aren't rich dad, poor dad, for example. The people that grow up in a rich family have a tendency to stay rich, and those that grow up in a poor family have a tendency to stay poor. It's not genetic, it's cultural belief and programming. And so what we have to recognize, there are people that did very well here, but they have cultural programs that differ from the masses right now. And unfortunately, it's still cultivated by the beliefs such as a Darwinian world that gives them, where they acknowledge, I am allowed to be here because I am successful in this competition, and I beat all the others. Great. And that's an unfortunate situation. I mean, that's like the banking community that is sucking the energy out of the system. With the concept that, oh, this is all right to do because it just reveals my level of evolution. And to me, it's like, no, it doesn't. That's devolution, because the evolution is the nature of what is humane, humanity, human. All those words are based on the first fundamental level of being compassionate, caring, sensitive. These are all these wonderful definitions. It's like, well, we call ourselves humans, and you know, we call ourselves collectively almost humanity, and it's like, we don't, at this moment, conform to any of the definitions of those terms. I mean, we can. We have the ability to do that. We just haven't been facilitated in our education and our programming.
But Bruce, every individual who's listening to this is probably, on the one hand, orienting themselves toward a life that's generous and loving, that has compassion and humanity. They're also contending with various challenges and threats, people who try to take advantage of them in various ways, competition that is more hostile, friends who support them, you know, a whole range of different experiences, but some of them difficult. And they're dealing with the larger conditions, which recently, at least economically, have been difficult for most people. And they're tending to contract and get uptight and fearful or angry as they encounter some of these things. And some of that anger may be appropriate. I mean, there may be people who really did swindle you, you know, swindle you. The bankers may have cratered our economy through their greed. You know, that there's a kind of healthy version of anger and then, of course, a destructive way of living it out. And they're not always knowing how to manage that complex of different feelings, all of which have some basis, in the most enlightened way. And based on looking so deeply into the mechanisms of evolution, biological cellular evolution and biological cellular control, do you have deeper insights into how we can be with that complex of feelings and challenges and opportunities that we face most effectively, when we sometimes have to defend ourselves against aggression and when we also need to affirm life and love?
Yeah, I everything you said is a very critical part of this evolutionary process. And the fact is, I'm not in my life. I am not a Pollyanna. Oh, it's all just beautiful and roses, and you know, ignore all that stuff. No, I'm a realist. I put away food. I'm getting ready. Why? Because there's going to be a disruption of this system. And if you think that, like most people think, oh, it's just bad now and it's going to get better, like it always does, I think this is, again, fooling yourself. There is going to be a crisis event. You must be prepared. At the same time, not to wall yourself off and protect yourself, because protection is, by definition, walling yourself off. This is time for growth, and growth means being open to taking things in, assimilating things. So there's a healthy amount of protection. Cover yourself as best you can, and then start really emphasizing the growth as well. So I don't mean be blind and just, you know, walk out, oh, yes, you know, I'll just walk across the interstate. Nobody, you know, they'll be nice. It's like, you got to be real here, too. So when I relate it to the analogy of the metamorphosis of a butterfly, I talk again about cells being miniature people, and I talk about the caterpillar as being under the skin of that caterpillar. There are 6-7 billion cells in there. Every cell is a sentient entity. Every cell has a job. They're working. Some in the digestive system, some in the muscular system. They all have jobs. They're getting paid. The caterpillar's growing. The economy's growing. Everything's growing really big. And everybody's in this state of luxuriant growth, and the happy days are here. And then one day, all of a sudden, the caterpillar stops growing and stops taking in food. And there's a point that said, what happens? What are the cells doing on the inside? They're looking around going like, "What? Hey, I'm a digestive cell. We don't have any food. We haven't had any food come in here for a while. I can't. This job doesn't work anymore." All the cells start getting laid off. All the cells are starting to look around like the thing is falling apart. This structure we lived in and created as a community does not work. It's falling apart. Many of the cells even commit suicide, biologically called apoptosis, in this process. So now all of a sudden what was this highly organized structural thing called a caterpillar turns into almost a soup of cells disconnected from the structure, and the soupy cells are like in a state of, oh my God, this whole thing is just falling apart. And then I say, yeah, and right in the midst of all that falling apart, they're genetically identical cells. They're the same genes as all the other cells, but they're cells that respond to the world with, in a different way. They're imaginal cells. They see a different vision, and it's interesting because they become the leadership of a new vision that the other cells that have just lost everything and the whole thing is soup. All of a sudden, the cells start to come together and create something that was even more advanced than the previous version, and that's when the butterfly comes out of the soup. And I say, well, Earth is now in late caterpillar, and the system is falling, and the people are losing their jobs, and they're finding that, you know, it's like it's not working, and all the cells are getting lost. And then I say, thank God you have your show. Thank God you have your listeners, because the listeners are part of an ever-growing community of imaginal cells who are going to see life in a different way. Know that we're in a wreck. It doesn't mean that we're not going in a wreck, but it says prepare. Don't be close your eyes and think it'll just go away in the morning. It's like, no, something is happening. So I'm a realist on one hand and also an optimist in that I see the need for this, and if I can take care of myself, then I can help other people and create community. And this is what the whole evolution is all about. The evolution is community, and we lost it, and we've lost it for a long time. And not only we lose the outside community, we lost the nuclear community. The family community has been broken up. This is a complete disempowerment of all humans. Power of humans is what is community, and so we are in a transition state. And it's, while it's falling apart in one sense, it's also time to start creating community and harmony and start hooking up with others and saying, look, we're going to go through some stuff. If we work together, we could do this. We could work together. We're going to get through this. It's going to be great. And as people start to come in to those communities and start to recreate communities and start to recognize that the happiness and joy that we were programmed to believe came in buying that new car or getting that diamond ring, it turns out that's not really happiness and joy. The more happiness and joy was in loving relationships, loving community, being a tourist of the world and seeing the beauty and splendor of the garden that we live in has more value than a diamond ring. But we have to switch from the diamond ring, you know, world that we live in.
Yeah, sure, sure. Yeah, become lovers and celebrators of life instead of consumers and viewers of it.
Well, it's part of the transition because basically we've run out of the materials anyway, so what are you going to do? And it's like, okay, well, how about, people say, well, if I get this new, sports car, I'm going to be really happy, and it'll make me extremely happy. And it's sort of like, well, maybe you could get happy without the car. And it's like, huh? So all of a sudden we have to start realizing that we hook all our happiness on this material accumulation because we lived in a Newtonian type universe that emphasized the material realm and ignored the invisible energy realm, which was a switch when quantum physics came in and said, no, wait, the energy invisible realm is more powerful in influencing life than the physical realm. So we're in that, part of that is the transition. And when people start to recognize the value of your life and your relationships and love and things like that and making community, and it's natural. That's the most fun part. It's built into every human when they're born. It's instinctual to be altruistic, supportive, and loving. That is a human characteristic, and somewhere in the programming period in the first 6 years of our lives, we've been programmed by others. And it's really interesting. People have to know this because it's like biology belief talks about the programming period and all that, and I'd like to say, well, this isn't new. The Jesuits for 500 years would say, give me a child until it's 6 or 7 and it will belong to the church for the rest of its life. They knew 500 years ago, if I program your first 6 years, I own you. And I try to suggest to people, you think that little fact was maybe insignificant and disappeared in the cracks over the last 500 years? Are you kidding me? We've all been programmed. We're living in the Matrix, and the idea is it's red pill time.
We're reprogramming ourselves right here, right now. That's exactly what we're doing together.
I'm glad. I am glad.
Yeah,
I don't know where the program's going, Terry, but I know as long as it doesn't stay in the same place, we're moving, and that's what the whole
right on, right on. Well, we're actually a little late in taking that break I promised. I'm sorry to interrupt because this is really juicy, but I want to give others a chance to ask questions, and I see that there have been a lot of really dynamic and interesting questions typed into the instant teleseminar window on people's computers. If you have another question, type it now. And if you've dialed in by telephone, if you press *2 on your keypad, you can raise your hand. And if you like what you've heard and you'd like to have more exposure to Bruce and his work, go to brucelipton.com where you can find his books and DVDs and CDs and podcasts and calendar and find out about other opportunities to hear him or see him in person. And you can find out the latest information on his work and his whereabouts, brucelipton.com. And I also want to let you know that in the next week or two, I'm going to begin the process of offering a free teleseminar and then a revised and upgraded version of my online course, Integral Spiritual Practice, which some of you have heard about. For those of you who haven't, I'm really gratified to be able to offer a step-by-step guide to taking on a truly integral practice that's heart-based, that engages all the functions of the human being, and that helps create a level of spiritual awakening, physical practice, emotional practice in a streamlined way that works in our lives. It is a unique and beautiful integrated process. The folks who have gone through the course have just, you know, made me blush with their expressions of joy and gratitude, and we're going to get a chance to tell you more about that and offer it to you just in the next little while. So please do take a look at some email messages that will arrive in your inbox from me, offering a juicy online seminar that will be free to get a taste of the unique depth and the dimension of an integral spiritual practice, and then for information about the course. And please stay on the line, because at the end of the call, before we all get a chance to hear each other's voices and say goodbye, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. And one of them is just this Sunday. Daniel Siegel will be joining me for a conversation we've been looking forward to for a while. That was originally scheduled 16th, but had to be postponed due to technical difficulties. And that's this Sunday at 10 a.m. Pacific time. And in November, there'll be conversations with Zen Sensei Diane Musho Hamilton, integral teacher Jeff Salzman, neuropsychologist Rick Hansen, and in December, Buddhist geek Vince Horn. Okay. Let's see what we have here. Well, you know, we have a couple of questions from people who were kind of troubled by the fact that very young children sometimes have disease, and they don't really have much in the way of belief. And they're asking, how is it that operates, and that some of those children get better and some of them don't? And you seem to be suggesting belief is playing such a central role, but that can't really be the full primary explanation for all these disease processes, can it?
No. Not at all. and when I started the conversation a long time ago, we talked about the fact that I got into this business being aspiritual, and that was my whole mission, you know, to get into the science of the mechanics and stuff like that. But I didn't mention that along that path, when I understood the nature of the cell membrane and how it worked, I also recognized that our personal identities are not built into the system. Our personal identities are distinguished by a set of antennas on the surfaces of our cells, a group of which medicine calls self receptors, receivers of self. It's like, and that's why no two people can exchange cells with each other, because our cells have these different antennas, and only your cells with your antennas can work in your body, and other cells put in your body, the immune system will reject it as not self. And what's the relevance is, well, if you cut the antennas off, the cells are generic and they'll be accepted by anybody's body. And the self receptors are, you say, well, that's the self. And I go, no, that's the fun part. they're called receptors. They're receivers of self. They're reading an environmental information, a cue. And what that really just blew my mind was I realized, oh, my God, the identity is some broadcast of some kind of information from the environment. Who we are, we're not in here. We step into this body. And it was really exciting because the first moment that came up to me, I'm going to get to the answer to that question, but why was it exciting? Because, first of all, I never believed in spirituality. And then I saw the mechanism, said, oh, my God, I'm not actually in here. And I saw it now as a scientific, my identity is picked up by these antennas. And the point about it was, if the cell dies, does the broadcast from the environment stop? And the answer is no. The broadcast is still there. And the relevance about that is sort of like a television set. It has an antenna, pulls in a show. You're watching TV. The picture tube goes. You say, oh, my God, the television's dead. Yes, it's not working anymore. And then you ask, what about the broadcast? And it's like, yeah, that's still on. And I realized at some point we are like these bodies that are receiving. We're like remote control. And very quickly, and the fun part about it, because I think it's fun, is that I was so, you know, perplexed because, I mean, first of all, I'm not spiritual, and then about like 2 minutes after I looked at this thing and said, oh, my God, I see it, you know. It's like, so I went from not spiritual to spiritual, like in that two-minute period. It was like blew me away. But what was interesting is I asked myself a question. I said, why have a spirit and a body? You know, as a biologist, because now that I've just been introduced to spirit, why have both? Why not just be a spirit? Well, you know, and the cells, I think, in my body came up with the answer, and the answer just came out right out of my head. It said, Bruce, if you're just a spirit, what does chocolate taste like? And all of a sudden, I started, oh, my God, the identity comes in. The body is, it converts our world into sensation. So we live as a spiritual awareness in the field, but when we have a body that's tuned to us with the right antennas, we enter into that body, which is not only sending information back to the source, to who I am, it's giving me sensations and things that I, as a spirit, I can have awareness of, but not like through eyes. Eyes are cellular, you know, nose, that's a cellular mechanism, ears, that's a cellular mechanism. So you jump into the suit and you have this life experience, and it's creative. So interesting point. I absolutely believe personally that this is heaven, because this is where I come to create and experience the world. And when the body is gone, I am left with the awareness of it, but not with the ability to be in that body to manipulate or make or create from my imagination, etc. Back to the answer to the question, I basically believe that when children come in and these problems are parents and children face these problems like that, some of this might be actually part of a teaching mechanism of spirit helping others learn things. And like even a Holocaust at some point could have been a giant teaching mechanism for civilization and humanity to understand. Why? Because if you see it, as I then saw it, different from the way, you know, once I became spiritual versus before I was spiritual. Before I was spiritual, this is your life, man. This is it. This is all you got. Go for it. Go for the gusto. Once I started to see that, if my identity is in the field and the bodies come and go, then I can come back and forth many different times. Anytime a new embryo comes up with the same set of antennas on it, that I'm back again. And I realize, well, God, we can come back and forth hundreds or thousands of times. And then you think about, well, if a child comes in as a spirit and this particular mission is to have some health issue, which may compromise and cause it to die, did it come in regard to being a teacher for others? Is that because, look, if you awareness that you can come back hundreds and hundreds of times, then giving one of these times as a teaching experience would make sense. So does a child come in as a blank slate, as an empty thing? No, I believe a child is connected to a spiritual awareness and environment, and that we as awareness units are teaching and compassionate and communicating individuals. And so when a child does that, is it possibly because that child has donated that particular existence to help others learn something? I'd like to consider it that way.
Yeah, okay, got it. That's good. Thank you. I want to hear some live questions. I want to get in a lot of questions. We've got a lot of questions and not too much time. Philip V. from Salmo, B.C., you're on the air. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Philippe Bonjour from Thalmo, and Bruce, I love the inspiration that you give me. I read Biology Belief a while ago. I used to belong to IONS and listen to your messages there, and have been very inspired by them. And I want to thank you very, very much for the work that you're doing. My question involves the possibility that, you know, all of our efforts in all of these things that we're doing to create community, to try to be better people and everything else, there's also this possibility that, you know, we're heading towards something that nobody has any concept of.
I agree.
And, that's the thing that I'm most open to.
Yeah, Philippe, I certainly appreciate your phone call, and thank you for listening to this stuff, because as I said, I love offering opportunity, because it just says, here's a mechanism. What you do with it is really a choice at this point. And obviously what's important is that you're really moving toward that choice point of doing this different thing. What's going to happen in front? That's what I just, you know, when Terry and I were talking, I said, there's this process which is part of quantum mechanics, and it's called emergence. And it's really the basis that says you bring a bunch of units together, and while you know the characteristics of each of the units, you will never be able to predict what the characteristic would be if they all came together. Basically, I'm on that same thing. I have no idea what the direction is, and I just figured if I learn to live my life in harmony, will this be better? And the answer is, well, of course it's better. And so I had to transcend my old belief systems, and that's the limitation. I think that's the hardest part of our entire evolution is the conscious mind is the creative mind that has the wishes and desires, and it's the mind that says, let's go out there and change the world. And then we find out that we only use that mind 5% of the time. That 95% comes from the subconscious, which are the programs that we got from other people. So while we have this great vision of living in the life that we want, we always end up struggling to get where we want to go. And it turns out a lot of people blame the universe and fate and all that, and it turns out it's basically our unconscious, subconscious behaviors that are playing 95% of the time, and by definition, rarely do we see them. So the whole issue is this is a great opportunity to make change, the biggest change we have to do is really come back into our own programmed subconscious beliefs and put those changes in as you're talking about. But where's the destination? Boy, Philippe, I wish I knew. My feeling is the most superb destination of human civilization would become a replica of the community of cells in the human body. Because, boy, they are the most efficient, and look what joy and happiness they create for us as the community in our mind, the community of these cells. If the human community could replicate that, then humanity would be able to express the same, where all 7 billion cells could be blissed out, and I'm really hoping that's the direction.
You know, and I so appreciate the positive attitude, because when I read your book, it really changed my negative thinking, like, oh, the world is going to end and we're all in deep, deep trouble, to, wow, what an opportunity, and, you know, let's start working together and build community and move in this direction. That's the exciting part. And, Bruce, I just want to tell you I love you very much, and God bless you for everything you're doing.
Philippe, as the imaginal cell you are, I love you, because your efforts are part of everyone's vision that, you know, this is what we must do, and you're a soldier out there, and God bless you for that.
All right. Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you, Philippe.
Yeah, and thank you for this opportunity. I got an email and just joined in, and thank you for making this happen.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you for tuning in. Well, we have lots and lots of questions here. Maybe we could have a series of kind of pithy short answers so we can get in a few more.
I'm going to try. I'm going to really try, Terry.
Okay.
I'm a man of millions of words.
Madani Knowles from Seattle asks, how do we live our lives in celebration in the honeymoon state?
The honeymoon state, it's in the book, is actually, I'm going to write, that's my next book, and it's basically the honeymoon state is a state which I refer to people, I say go back to that state when you experience something like that, you were your healthiest you ever were, you had the most energy you ever had, that life was so beautiful you couldn't even wait for the next day, you were literally experiencing heaven on earth. I say, how did that happen? The answer was this, as science has now backed this up as well. It is the one time in your life where you strictly operate from your conscious mind. The usual life is 5% from the conscious mind, but when you're in a honeymoon, it's 100%. And why is that important? Because the conscious mind is you, your spirit, your wishes, your desires. And when we operate from our conscious minds and we're creating from our wishes and desires, when our minds are traveling, which is the conventional understanding, that we only are operating 5% of the time because our minds are moving around and not focusing. And that's why our lives don't match our visions until that honeymoon period, when all of a sudden you feel that. And for me, that's most important, because that honeymoon period was not an accident. That was a personal creation. You created heaven on earth. Anybody can do this, and we can all do this. And if you understand how you created it, then you have an opportunity to make that a way of life for your entire life.
Beautiful. Cynthia from South Hill says, I understand that belief is the key. Do you have any suggestions for breaking free of the old underground patterns of belief that influence us so much outside our awareness?
Yeah, well, the first thing is very simply this. A lot of people say, well, what are the programs in my subconscious mind that are sabotaging me? And I say, well, it's interesting, 95% of your life is a printout. So basically, your life is a printout of your subconscious, and it says everything that works for you in your life works because you have programs in your system that support that. Anything you effort, you have to put struggle into or work hard to get at, or, you know, just making a big effort overall. The reason why you're doing that is because you have limiting beliefs regarding those directions and issues that you're working on. So now you know what to work on, and then I say, how do you change them? And there's three fundamental ways, and this is the way that the subconscious has learned. This is a mechanism, and why it doesn't learn in any other way. So reading self-help books and all that's not necessarily going to help. The subconscious learns by hypnosis, which it did for the first 6 years of your life, being in a low brain frequency theta. That's what happened. And secondly, after you're six, you learn by habit. Anything you repeat religiously can become a habit. And once it becomes a habit, then it becomes unconscious. And then it will happen automatically, whether you pay attention to it or not anymore. And my
which, by the way, is the secret of practice.
Yeah, well, that's
exactly
that's
what I teach. So yeah,
well, I'll let you talk about that, Terry, because that's basically that's the way we learned anything. At ABC, you had to repeat that until you got it. Driving a car, you had to repeat it until you got it. A sticky note on the refrigerator, I refer to that as a wish, because that's not an exercise or a practice, or it's not even regular. So habits, and then lastly, there's a new variety of interesting psychology called energy psychology, which I think is my personal feeling is the equivalent of something called super learning process with brain balance, right and left hemisphere, getting in balance and creating a super learning situation so you can reprogram in minutes. My website, brucelipton.com, has resources, and there's a whole set of resources of all these different kinds of modalities of changing beliefs. But Terry's work is fundamental. That's the whole idea of practice. And I said, that's the way we learned after six anyway. So you want to relearn anything and put it in your subconscious, you have to do the same way you put anything in your subconscious, is put a practice and a repetition to it.
Beautiful. Thank you, Bruce. Let's take another live caller. I don't have the name of this person, but you're calling from a 941 area code, and you're live. Please introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Joan Lawrence, and I've so enjoyed listening to you, both of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My question is, the tipping point, the 10% of humanity, will that have any effect on the supposed polar shift that's coming in 2012 for the actual planetary shift?
Well, personally, again, it's the mystery of the future. I don't know. I think getting together, but does human consciousness interact with the field? The answer is we've now established that with what is called the Global Coherence Project at HeartMath in Boulder Creek, California, is working with. They have revealed that human consciousness, when certain events in the world happen, we actually change the magnetic field of the Earth through the combined conscious activity, all focusing on the same kind of thing when you reach a large number. So could this be cultivated so that an even larger number of people putting their consciousness on a topic changed the field enough to change the Earth. I believe it actually can, and that's why I have a very more optimistic outlook about the future than those that don't see consciousness playing a role. I think, indeed, we can. We've already demonstrated that consciousness does change the field, so now we just have to understand it deeper and work with it more.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Ernest from Oakland, Ernest Zitos, asks a very interesting question. Do you see any evidence of a morphogenetic field, something beyond spatial, temporal, physical proximity? In your study of biology, do you find any evidence of teleology and the emergent properties of evolution? Is there something transcendental across space and time as an overall guidance, or is it all trial and error, evolve or die due to the pressures of environment?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I think there's trial and error involved, but I also see an overall guidance in the simple reality that nature, by its definition and organization, is built in what is called fractal geometry. And fractal geometry is an interesting geometry. It is the math that geometry is how you put structure into space. The geometry we learned in school, Euclidean geometry, builds buildings and machines and things like that, but doesn't create trees or clouds and things like that. And fractals do, and then you say, well, that's nice. The universe is, the environment is fractal. I go, but then there's a profound piece of a fractal that becomes very critical, and that is that it is the math that proves scientifically the concept of as above, so below. And basically says if you can understand the patterns at one level, these patterns will be imprinted upon the structure at any other level as well. And therefore, I clearly see that the organization and the evolution that we're going through is not an accidental random event at all, that it certainly comes down to a fractal pattern playing itself out, and that's why I've started to emphasize and focus the nature of, if you want to understand community, then look at the 50 trillion cells that created the community and technology of the human body. It's a fractal image. You're going to get the answers there. So I think the answers are already in the field. It's just our awareness of reading the answers, and the more effective we are at reading the answers, the less trial and error will constitute part of that evolution.
Thank you, Bruce. That makes sense. Yeah. Can you go a few minutes beyond 7 o'clock,
Yeah, let's
Bruce?
Go. Let's go. We're
okay.
On a roll. Let's get a couple in there.
Yeah, let's get a couple
more questions.
I'll try
and make them brief, but that's difficult.
Yeah, we've got a question, a live caller from Cincinnati, Ohio, Topmiller.
Yes, that is me.
Hi.
Yes, Topmiller. Thank you very much.
Hello.
Beth, welcome.
Hi. Thank you. I'm pretty new to your show or whatever you want to call this, but I'm blown away. I think this is absolutely wonderful. Quick question. You referred to quantum physics. Were you referring to the famous experiment where the observer affects the experiment?
That's indeed part of it, but the quantum physicists from the very beginning in 1925 and 1930 recognized that human consciousness is an integral part of the experience on this planet, and that our efforts to think that we are observers of everything and not participants has thrown a monkey wrench into all the understanding, because our participating and observing is influencing the outcome, even to the extent that recently cosmologist Stephen Hawking actually commented on his most recent paper with a Hertig, I think, as he co-authored it, and it was basically a paper that says and established the, from their perception that human consciousness is actually even changing cosmology. So this thing is getting bigger and deeper, and then we have all this non-local interaction stuff. We have Amit Goswami's work on entangling minds at great distances, et cetera, and all these wonderful things are adding to a non-local reality that is influencing all of us. So it opens up all new visions that the conventional world beliefs have put under the table, but now they're opening up. So it's like, it's very exciting. That's all I can say.
Thank you. And quick, when you talked about Lamarck kind of versus Darwinism, how do you spell that guy's name, Lamarck? Is it L-A-M-A-R-K?
M-A-R-C-K. His first name is Jean-Baptiste. John the Baptist Lamarck.
Okay.
And They call him a buffoon, and it turns out he has the most accurate interpretation of evolution at the current moment, especially with the new science of epigenetics, because the epigenetics is our genetic expression is modified by our interaction with the environment, and this is exactly what Lamarck talked about in 1809.
Fantastic. Well, we have a lot of rich questions that have already been typed in. I want to maybe ask a couple of them real quickly. We have listeners all over the world here. We haven't been able to take them all, but I'd like to take one from Jillian in Nimbin, Australia. Don't right beliefs have to be sourced in spiritual connection? Otherwise, aren't you simply replacing one layer of conditioning with another?
What kind of beliefs? Right beliefs?
Yeah. Healthier beliefs, I think she means, essentially.
Well, it's basically there's our belief systems are acquired through our life experiences and our cultures and stuff like that. And so basically why this is important is that as we become more aware, as we start to learn deeper understanding and deeper truth, we start to see that not the human part, but nature has a great harmony built into the system, and we are part of that nature, and yet we have disconnected ourselves. So it says, is there a better way of living on this planet? Can we learn that? And the answer is, of course we can learn that, and that's why we go through the trials and errors that we do, and there are periods where we try something out, and it works for a while, and then at some point we run into, it wasn't really a complete understanding, so now that thing that we were doing is actually causing a problem, and this is why we're coming through a new evolution. Is it right or wrong? The new one is right for the current moment. The old one is not right for the current moment. If you ask me 100 years ago, is it right? At that time, the one that's fading out now, the Darwinian and all that Newtonian stuff, it worked. It worked beautifully, but now it's time for something maybe more, and put it in quotes, more right, because the clear reality is doing what we're doing is now leading to extinction. So obviously that's not right.
Great. Thank you, Bruce. Well, we have questions from Europe and Latin America and all over the place, but I think we have to complete. And there's just a lovely, simple, and beautiful question that Rachel Oliver from Mariposa typed in. Is there a first step that we, and first of all, I, can take to bring about this evolution in the least chaotic way?
Absolutely. And the first thing is to understand your power as a human being over not only the creation of the health inside of your body, but your participation and involvement with the creation and the life that you are experiencing. It is not an accident. It is not a coincidence. We have given up our power and said fate or, you know, whatever, that's not in my cards and all that kind of stuff. And it turns out, that's why I like the honeymoon effect. I go back and I say to people, look, when you operate the system, you know, wonderfully the way it does when you have a honeymoon. And I go back to the honeymoon because it's not just a physiological expression. It's also life was so beautiful. And the fact is, what was so different? And what was different was we let go of the limiting and disempowering program that all children are brought into this planet with. And so you want to know the first step, and the first step is to say, take those beliefs and wishes and desires of your conscious mind and try to make those the programs in your subconscious mind by whatever way you get it in there. Because then as your mind is traveling during the day and you default to the subconscious, what would happen to your life if your subconscious had the same beliefs that your conscious mind had? The answer is that heaven you experience would be there whether you were paying attention or not. And that, I think, is the biggest clue is, and it's so exciting because most people have had that honeymoon. That's why I like to refer back to it. It's like, go back. That was a creation. It was not a coincidence, nor was it an accident. And recognize you created heaven, and we can do it again.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Bruce, and thank you, everybody. Before I tell you about what's coming up on Sunday and open up the lines to say goodbye, a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it too. You can go to our Facebook page and you can like it and you can point that out to others. You can direct them to registering for the series at beyondawakeningseries.com. And if you appreciate what Bruce has communicated today, you can visit his website, brucelipton.com. And please also stay tuned and take a good look at this amazing course we're going to be taking together starting in just a month or so. You'll be hearing more about that. And to learn more about my work and see videos and audios and other writings by me, visit integralspiritualpractice.com. This Sunday, October 30th, at 10 a.m., neuropsychiatrist Daniel Siegel will be joining me for a dialogue in which he basically talks about how our definition of the self as a singular noun has put our species on planet Earth at risk. What he suggests is intentionally redefining the self, not as a singular noun, but as a plural verb, an ever-emerging interdependent selfing process, which can enable us to empower our species to improve our personal health, our community health, and our planet. Now, that'll be 10 a.m. this coming Sunday. And then on November 13th, I'll be talking with Zen Sensei Diane Musho Hamilton and Integral Teacher Jeff Salzman about cosmic creativity. On November 27th, neuropsychologist Rick Hansen will join me to talk about the brain of a Buddha. And on December 11th, I'll be joined by Buddhist geek Vincent Horn for a geek's eye view of the future of spiritual practice. Thanks so much for joining Bruce and me today. Let's open up our phone lines so that we can hear the voices of those of us who've called in by phone, and we can all say goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lots of love, you guys. Thank you.
Aloha Nui.
Thank you. Thank you.
Aloha. Namaste.
Namaste.
Thank you.